morning. I'll reconvene with him.
Thank you. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the Kiwi Birdlife Park, and I have with me the park manager, Paul Kavanagh, who has prepared evidence. I will start with my legal submissions, and then Mr. Kavanagh has prepared a one-page summary of his evidence that he will read out.
Thank you.
The Kiwi Birdlife Park operates a wildlife park from 51 Brecon Street, and perhaps before I launch into these submissions, if I could just take you to the location of the park on the planning map that's been provided. We've highlighted in orange the boundaries of the park, and you can see that directly off Brecon Street there's a small portion that is within the town centre zone and not within the informal recreation zone. That's if you're familiar with the park where the entrance tunnel is located, and then you drop down to the balance of the park, which is in the informal recreation zone, Ben Lyman subzone. And what I will also refer to in my submissions is the area of land that is shown with a red outline, which is the Ben Lyman subzone lower terminal. So that is the area of the Skyline development.
Yes, we are familiar with the area. We visited and we walked down through the Skyline car park to the very back, so we could overlook into the building.
Thank you, it's helpful. Paragraph 3 of my submissions. Under the operative district plan, the land is identified on planning map 35 as high density residential, overlaid with designation 1214 Kiwi Park Recreation Reserve. The Kiwi Birdlife Park is a commercial enterprise, however, as set out in the evidence of Mr. Kavanagh, a significant portion of the activities it carries out fall within the categories of education, community, wildlife, and nature conservation. This enterprise directly contributes to and facilitates communities' well-being and development while providing an efficient use of land. In its submission, Kiwi Birdlife Park supported the explanation in the policy suite for the informal recreation zone, which recognises existing activities in the Ben Lomond subzone, including the Kiwi Birdlife Park operation, and that further development is contemplated. Would you like me to read out that extract or take it as read? Kiwi Birdlife Park noted in its submission that it is concerned that the objectives and policies do not sufficiently support commercial activities such as the Kiwi Birdlife Park, which actively supports wildlife and education and tourism, while at the same time maintaining or enhancing the landscape and amenity values. Kiwi Birdlife Park sought greater support for this type of activity in the objectives and policies for the zone. Certain development rights were afforded under the ODP provisions, which are proposed to be replaced by Chapter 38. The Kiwi Birdlife Park sought a greater degree of support in the provisions for future development of the land, where it is directly related to its current purpose. The Skyline Terminal adjacent to the land is proposed to be rezoned Ben Lomond Subzone Lower Terminal. The Kiwi Birdlife Park has entered into agreements with Skyline regarding its current development proposals, but it is concerned that the extent of the potential development which could occur on the lower terminal subzone will have adverse effects on the environment, including its site. The Kiwi Birdlife Park supports proposed policy 38.4.1.5, which provides a directive about the adverse effects of activities in this zone on the surrounding environment. This is an important outcome for the Kiwi Birdlife Park as it seeks to protect the interface with the adjacent lower terminal subzone. Take that extract as read. However, the Kiwi Birdlife Park seeks greater protection in the zone provisions to protect the interface between the lower terminal subzone and the Kiwi BirdLife Park operations. I've then set out in paragraph 11 a summary of the submission relief, which is a direct extract from the submission itself. The Kiwi BirdLife Park lodged a further submission in respect of the submission by Skyline. Skyline proposed amendments to the planning map to include a new area for a helipad, and the informal airports rule was opposed on the basis that an informal airport in this area is provided for as a restricted discretionary activity. This could have a significant impact on amenity and Kiwi BirdLife Park's conservation activities, which are consistent with the purpose of the zone.
Are you talking at that point about the proposal by Skyline?
Up in the upper terminal area.
Yes.
To extend it to the north and the east.
Yes.
In essence, really what I've set out in the submissions on that point is that the Kiwi BirdLife Park supports the council's position, which has been to reject the relief sought by Skyline in respect of the activity status. I'm just summarising my submissions here, but in paragraph 13, if I go back to there, the further submission noted that Kiwi BirdLife Park opposition can be addressed by limiting the number of flights and set out a number of restrictions which were consistent with the previous Environment Court decision. And that decision was attached to Mr. Kavanagh's evidence. But that was on the basis that if the Commission was prepared to extend those areas, and if it was, then Kiwi BirdLife Park would like to see those restrictions imposed so that they're consistent with the Environment Court decision. However, if the Commission reminded to accept Council's position that those areas are not, that the zone is not expanded to those areas, and that it remains as a restricted discretionary activity status, then the relief sought by Kiwi BirdLife Park is not required.
Okay, there's another twist to this that I did ask you about. Now that the land is zoned rural, that piece of land will be zoned rural, and in the rural zone where it is dockland and the owner has a concession, informal airports are permitted activity as long as they are 500 metres away from the zone boundary. And they won't be 500 metres from the zone boundary, but then it becomes discretionary activity if you breach that standard. Now, given that situation, which is the preferable outcome for your client? And you might want to think about that and take instructions rather than just turn it on the hoof, because in reality you've ended up with three possible scenarios that we've got in front of us, is the existing, what Skyline has sought, and then the version of Skyline with your additional standards, as I see it.
Yes, I can understand that issue. So I will take instructions, thank you.
And I mean, I think it might pay you to check provisions in Chapter 21 of the Decisions Version.
Yes.
But you understand that it may be, because we've got this time gap this morning,
thank you. I understand. Is it the position that, so Skyline has confirmed they're not, they will be within the 500 metres?
Oh, that's
clear on the.
Yeah, you need to walk up there to see that that's the case. It would be about 100 metres at the most.
So it's a discretionary under the rule, if you want.
Mm-hmm. it's on page 22 of the appeals version of.
It's normal, two flights a day.
No. I'm concession there, it's not.
That's right.
Thank you. If I return to paragraph 15 of my submissions, Mr. Kavanagh filed evidence in relation to the Kiwi Birdlife Park's key aspects of concern. The first is the amendments to the building height rules to provide for bird aviary enclosures. The Council's Section 42A report rejects the Kiwi Birdlife Park submission seeking an increase from 6 metres to 10 metres in height for aviary enclosures. The reason for the author's opposition are increasing maximum height has the potential to result in adverse effects on character and amenity, shading, dominance and visual effects. Mr. Kavanagh addressed this matter in detail in his evidence, however Ms. Edgley remained unconvinced. She notes that Rule 38.11.1 requires a resource consent for a restricted discretionary activity for any new building or extension. She notes that as any building would require a resource consent anyway, it will be possible to assess any proposed additional height in the same application with no additional consenting requirements. She also notes that the Kiwi Birdlife Park is not within an ONL or outstanding natural feature or rural character landscape, therefore the landscape assessment matters in 38.15 would not be triggered. Overall, it's her view that the notified provisions are more efficient than including a site-specific exemption. We do not accept this rationale. Ms. Edgley has failed to acknowledge that the breach of the height restriction will trigger a discretionary consent, which is a more stringent requirement than a restricted discretionary consent. Accordingly, the application and consenting process will be more onerous, costly, and potentially uncertain, and it cannot be considered to be more efficient as suggested by Ms. Edgley. Mr. Kavanagh gave evidence justifying the need for a fence height of 2.2 metres for predator protection and requested an exemption from the rule on height for fencing for the Kiwi Birdlife site. Ms. Edgley states in her rebuttal evidence that Rule 38.10.7.2 only applies to fences erected on the boundary of the zone, so internal fencing would not be affected, and existing use rights would apply for the replacement of any existing fencing, providing this was legally established. She also notes that the matters of discretion for a resource consent for this rule include functional constraints, so Mr. Kavanagh's points in paragraph 22 to 25 would be able to be taken into account. Likewise, with building height, she considers that the provisions as notified are more efficient than having a site-specific exemption. Again, we do not agree with this position. Fencing on the Kiwi Birdlife site has been erected in some cases 30 years ago. There is no easy or cost-effective way to establish that it was lawfully established. In the absence of being able to prove this point, a consent would be required and the fence proposed would be well in excess of the permitted 1.2 metres. The Kiwi Birdlife Park would have to establish a case to justify the increased height, which cannot be said to be a more efficient process than a site-specific exemption. The next point relates to increases in retail space ancillary to permitted activities. The Kiwi Birdlife Park sought in its submission to increase the gross floor area for retail activities ancillary to permitted activities from the current 100 square metres 10% limitation, as well as amendments to the activity table to provide for commercial retail and restaurant cafe activity ancillary to the Kiwi Birdlife Park operation as a permitted activity. As noted in Mr. Kavanagh's evidence, the Kiwi Birdlife Park has invested significantly into its retail facilities on site, which provide a diverse offering, including ticketing and admissions, the Honeybee Centre, souvenir shop, gallery and cafe. These facilities directly support the operations of the park and enhance the overall visitor experience, as well as providing a necessary diversification of income streams. The KPB does not necessarily oppose the 100 square metre limitation above, as long as it's clear that the established park operations would fall to be a permitted activity in the table 38.1. Currently, this is not entirely clear, as the example activity is a broad category, and Mr. Kavanagh seeks an amendment to Rule 38.9.26 to identify that the species conservation work that the Kiwi Birdlife Park undertakes is a permitted activity within the zone. In rebuttal evidence, Ms. Edgeley considers that the term species protection and conservation management works in Rule 38.9.26, as notified, covers the Kiwi Birdlife Park operations, and further wording is not necessary. As outlined in Mr. Kavanagh's evidence, the Kiwi Birdlife Park currently carries out a broad range of activities and associated retail activities. Apologies, there's a typo there. The Kiwi Birdlife Park wants to ensure these activities are captured, as that appears to be the intention. We consider that the wording proposed by Mr. Kavanagh puts the matter beyond doubt and accordingly is a better and more efficient approach. Policy support relating to the interface between the Kiwi Birdlife Park and Skyline sites. Kiwi Birdlife Park sought in its submission to provide better protection of the interface between its site and the Skyline Lower Terminal, as outlined in their introduction to Mr. Kavanagh's evidence. The Kiwi Birdlife Park's main concern stems from its objective to protect wildlife within its enclosures from adverse external effects. As noted in his evidence, the Section 42A report considers that such changes are not necessary and that the Kiwi Birdlife Park would be considered as part of any resource consent application as an affected neighbour. Mr. Kavanagh notes that this is potentially inconsistent with the amendments to Rule 38.12, non-notification, included in the same report. The amendments to this rule seek to remove the following: controlled activities within the informal recreation, Ben Lomond subzone shall not be publicly notified, but may require the written approval of affected persons or give limited notification to affected persons. The removal of this rule is of concern to the Kiwi Birdlife Park, and that controlled activities provided for can have adverse effects on the Kiwi Birdlife Park. And without sufficient policy support relating to the interface of the two sites, there will be little protection against proposals which have adverse effects on its wildlife. Furthermore, any notification of particular activities would be an effects-based assessment, which does not guarantee Kiwi Birdlife Park's involvement in all future consent applications. The requirement to obtain written approvals is an onerous one and encourages good communication and participation between parties. This is particularly important in the subzone, which has diverse activities and needs, and will lead to better community and integrated planning outcomes. As noted above, policy support is required to ensure that all new proposals do not have adverse effects on established operations. This is particularly important for the Ben Lomond subzone, which hosts a diverse range of activities and operations. This could be appropriately provided for within the proposed new suite of policies specified for the subzone at 38.4.1.7 to 8.4.1.9. As set out in Mr. Kavanagh's evidence, and I have repeated the provision proposed underneath. In rebuttal, Ms. Edgeley acknowledges Mr. Kavanagh's request for greater protection of the Kiwi Birdlife Park from neighbouring activities, including the new Ben Lomond subzone policy to specifically address reverse event sensitivity effects and the reinstatement of the requirement for written approvals for controlled activities in that zone. Mr. Edgeley considers that there is sufficient district-wide and zone subzone policies that deal with effects and conflicts between users, but does not specifically reference the provisions. Despite Mr. Kavanagh's details of the sensitive nature of the park's operations and sensitivity of Kiwi to noise and vibration in particular, particular, she remains of the opinion set out in the Section 42A report that as controlled activities, any adverse effects on neighbours are able to be addressed through conditions of consent, and that that approach is consistent with the 2017 RMA amendments on notification. Although the approach is generally consistent with the RMA amendments on notification, in these circumstances, it is unlikely the true extent and impact of the effects of development on the Kiwi BirdLife site will be able to be determined by council staff without the involvement of the Kiwi BirdLife Park and its expertise in wildlife protection. Without the Kiwi BirdLife Park involvement, it is also unlikely the council will have the expertise to determine the conditions required to suitably mitigate effects. Accordingly, it's entirely appropriate in this instance to retain the role as notified.
Ms. Rob, I just wonder, are there reverse sensitivity effects that we're talking about, or and who is going to suffer the reverse sensitivity effects, or is it actual direct effects?
I apologise, you're correct, it's the direct effect, not...
Yeah, so the policy itself, should the policy itself be referring to reverse sensitivity?
No, I accept that point. The reverse should be deleted from the policy. Turning now to the point about increased heights for car parks and activity status within the Skyline site. Paragraph 36, as discussed in paragraph 11.28 of the Section 42A report, Skyline sought that parking within the lower terminal area of the subzone be permitted rather than controlled, and an increase in height limits from 17 to 20 metres. Kiwi BirdLife Park opposes those increases to permitted standards for parking buildings within the lower terminal area. These increased allowances have the potential to create adverse impacts on the Kiwi BirdLife Park, such as through increased noise, light spill, and other adverse amenity effects on the park. Kiwi BirdLife Park supported the Council's conclusions on these matters at 11.28 and 11.29 of the Section 42A report, opposing the increase in height and the permitted activity status. However, in rebuttal evidence, Ms. Edgley states, Skyline has supplied landscape evidence from the Snodgrass in support of their request to increase the height from 17 metres to 20 metres in the lower terminal area of the Ben Lomond subzone. She noted that in the Section 42A report, she recommended increasing the height in this area to 17.5 metres. However, this recommendation was not carried through to the recommended chapter in Appendix 1. She acknowledges Mr. Dent's evidence where he states that the original height limits were proposed based on the height of future buildings in that area, and now that more refined building heights are known, it is appropriate to increase the height limits in recognition of buildings likely to be developed. She understands Mr. Dent's reference to likely future buildings in the lower terminal area to be those proposed by resource consents RM 160647 and 17.1172 for the lower terminal building, which is 18.3 metres above ground level, and the multi-level car park building at 19.9 metres above the original ground level, respectively. The application for RM 160647 has an interim decision issued, and the Environment Court has yet to make the final decision on RM 171172. Note that Kiwi BirdLife Park has been involved directly in those proceedings in terms of agreements with Skyline regarding those buildings.
Is that hearing being held on the car park? The 171172 hearing?
My understanding is that there has been a hearing. So the Kiwi BirdLife Park was when I say directly involved, Kiwi BirdLife Park was a Section 274 party to the direct referral of RM 16, and then entered into an agreement and did not join the proceedings for RM 17. But we understand that the hearing has been held, and there's but the final decision The closing submissions and final conditions have been submitted to the court, but no final decision has been issued.
Trying to get a handle on where it was at.
Yes, so I think it's
that
close to conclusion.
It may come out before we issue our reports, for example.
Yes, I'm not sure of the timing on that. So returning to paragraph 42, Mr. Edgeley remains with the view that the increase in height to a maximum of 20 metres to reflect the application currently before the Environment Court should not be accepted, but considers that the maximum height limit could be increased to reflect the maximum height of the lower terminal building in the interim decision of RM 16 of 18.5 metres. Kiwi Birdlife Park agrees with Ms. Edgeley that the 20 metre height sought by Skyline is reliant on a specific design that is at the time of writing for the Environment Court. If it were to be constructed, Skyline is entitled to rely on that consent to enable the building to the height proposed. A large portion of the lower terminal area is located within an ONL, and Kiwi Birdlife Park agrees that a discretionary status should be applied in order to assess the proposal against the landscape assessment matters under 38.15, as well as any relevant objectives and policy. Kiwi Birdlife Park supports the conclusion of Ms. Edgeley's rebuttal evidence regarding the requested permitted activity status, where she states, following my recommendation to remove the other matters of control in the Section 42A report, the only matter left for consideration under this rule is landscaping. And while I agree with Mr. Dent at paragraph 172 that there is a history of car parking in this area, and that vegetation screens the western and northern areas, while the Kiwi Birdlife Park boundary is currently being planted, there is no requirement to retain the trees on the Kiwi Birdlife site, as evidenced by the recent removal of, on that property, and the forest to the west and north could be removed on this basis. I recommend that this matter and rule be retained. Extension of the Ben Lomond subzone and inform more airport activities. This part of my submissions essentially just repeats the discussion that we had earlier this morning. So I'll take instructions on that matter and revert.
For you, and we've asked the same of various other people, is regarding the extent to which the plan can require public or limited notification of control activities in the light of the recent changes to the Resource Management Act about notification.
Yes. I am aware of those discussions, and there are mixed views on that. I think what Kiwi Birdlife Park was specifically looking for was the retention of the part of the review, part of the rule that requires affected party approval.
You can't actually require affected party approval.
You enable
limited notification provisions to happen, and then if they get limited party approval, that deals with it.
Yes, I think the wording was that it may require effective party approval, but...
So my question is, given the changes in the Resource Management Act, can the plan now do that? Or the fact that the plan says it becomes sort of null and void?
Well, I understand it's not tested, so in that respect, I don't think that from the wording of the new provisions that it is absolutely precluded. There is still, with all the different steps that have to be worked through, ultimately, you know, the ability to look at special circumstances, and arguably that opens the door. And I think until it is tested, it's open for argument that it could be interpreted that way, and plans could be more directive in that respect.
Okay. So there's sufficient greyness or doors open within those provisions, do you think, for to be worthwhile for the plan to say what it intends regarding notification or non-notification?
Yes, that's my opinion.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll move on to Mr.
Kavanagh. Kia ora, good morning. Thank you for hearing me this morning. So, Kew Birdlife Park, as Vanessa said, we operate a wildlife park in 51 Bracken Street, and we lease the land from QLDC. And we opened to the public in January 1986. So we are a commercial enterprise, and the commercial side of our operation funds our conservation work. And as Vanessa said, a significant portion of our activities fall within the categories of education and advocacy, community, and wildlife and nature conservation. And the amendments sought to the proposed district plan directly relate to protecting our existing operations, allowing for sensitive growth and cost efficiencies, which, as I said, funds our conservation work and community work and education. And the big thing working with wildlife, we're always looking to keep improving and keep improving our standards and keep growing, so we just want to enable that. I filed evidence in relation to the amendment of rules to include an exemption to the maximum height limits of aviaries and fences on our site, the amendment of rules to explicitly include the Kiwi Birdlife Park operations as a permitted activity, the introduction of a new policy to protect Kiwi Birdlife Park existing operations from new activities, provisions relating to height and activity status in the lower terminal area of the BLSZ, and the retention of a discretionary activity status for the informal airports in the BLSZ. I've considered the views expressed by Ms. Christine Edgley in respect of my evidence regarding a new exemption to allow Kew Birdlife Park aviaries to have a permitted maximum height of 10 metres. We just want to provide the highest standard of aviaries as possible, and many aviaries around the country far exceed our request of 10 metres, like Auckland Zoo's forest aviaries, 18 metres, Hamilton Zoo's is well over 20. So I don't think 10 metres is beyond our remit. Ms. Edgley considers the notified provisions to be more efficient that include site-specific exemption. I understand that a discretionary consent will be required rather than a restricted discretionary consent. I've recently been involved in consents for our new Kiwi exhibit and appreciate the cost and time involved. So I do not agree with this comments from a practical and financial perspective. Although I appreciate I'm not an expert in these matters, I am a conservationist, I do believe that 10 metre aviaries, which are see-through mesh, basically transparent mesh, will create far less impacts than buildings which have been recently consented on surrounding sites, such as iFly and Skyline developments. Ms. Edgley supports an increase in height for the Skyline terminal buildings to 18.5 metres, which is adjacent to our site, and therefore it just seems a bit inconsistent. In respect of my request for an exemption from the rule on height for fencing, Ms. Edgley points out that existing use rights will apply for the replacement of any existing fence, providing that these were legally established. And as Vanessa said, a lot of our fences were established 33 years ago, so it would be very difficult to prove that they were lawfully constructed. However, they are an integral part of our operations for pest control. Also, some of our existing fences are less than the optimal predator protection height of 2.2 metres. So I fail to understand how the provisions, as noted, are more efficient than having a site-specific exemption, as we would have to go to considerable time and financial expense to prove that the fences were lawfully established or to include further assessment in any resource consent application. I sought an amendment to Rule 38.9.26 to identify that the species conservation work and activities that we undertake is a permitted activity within the IRZ. Ms. Edgley considers that the terms species protection and conservation management works in Rule 38.9.26 as notified, and she feels that these cover our operations and that further wording is not necessary. We just wanted to be certain, basically, that this is the case to ensure future work of the park is protected, and that there's no further costly debates with council in the future. It's also extremely important that we do have the protection from neighbouring activities, given the purpose of our zone and the sensitive nature of our park operations. So accordingly, I respectfully request that the amendments sought in my evidence are included in the proposed plan provisions.
Thank you.
before we ask questions of Mr. Cavanaugh, as well, wondering if you could help me, in terms of this height issue, is it relevant for us to consider that when the plan was notified in 2015, the wildlife park, the bulk of it was notified as high density residential with a height limit of 12 metres or 15 metres, depending on how you built the building. Is that a relevant consideration for us in assessing the height of the proposal now, when the council by variation had changed that same?
Yes, I did reference just, and only, you're right, I only glossed over that matter, that there has been development rights essentially, well, the site was afforded certain development rights that have been taken away in that respect. I suppose it does go to the overall comparison of, or consideration of, whether these rules, first of all, you have to go to the objectives, whether they're the best way of achieving the objectives and policies, but when looking at that, whether they're overall more efficient and effective than what we have currently. And on that basis, I think you can take it into consideration.
Certainly in 2015, the council considered that that heartland was an appropriate heartland.
Yes, so there must have been an analysis at that time to say that it was appropriate under the provisions of the Act.
And presumably we would find an analysis in the Section 32.
To justify why it's no longer the case.
Yes.
Okay. And I have to confess, although I did read those some time back, nothing jumped out at me that specifically considered that matter, but I may have missed something. It may well be there, and I can't recall.
Okay.
Yes, this is it's basically looking at your paragraph 17 where you're talking about this fence height that you're seeking. First question is, has anybody opposed this, your submission on this point? Any of your neighbours opposed it? Your knowledge?
Not to my
knowledge. In fact, you've asked for 10 metres.
For the Averys?
Yep.
I will just check that. No, I don't think that's the case. I do have the further submissions. The fence height.
Yeah, so you saw 10 metres, so none of your neighbours have come along and opposed it.
10 metres for the Averys and 2.2 for
yes,
the...
Yeah.
Yes, yep. That's right. So, as Ms Edgley pointed out, the internal boundaries within the zone are not captured by that rule, and it's just the external boundaries, which is over the back of the park. Can see over there where it bounds the white, so that's the external boundaries would be caught by that rule, and none of those neighbours have submitted an opposition to that request.
Now, then, is the Avery fences on that orange hatched area attached to the plan, do they extend right up to the boundaries, or are they right back to the boundaries?
No, they don't extend to the boundaries generally.
So your neighbours there, you've obviously got Ben Loman subzone on the uphill side, if you put it that way.
Yep.
Now on the northern side, it looks like a row of sections along there. What are those?
That's Pinewood Lodge. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's Pinewood.
Pinewood Lodge is a combination place.
Yep.
And on your eastern boundary, I think I presume it's the primary school.
Primary school, the playing fields at the primary school.
Okay. So those are basically your neighbours, apart from some land in the reserve itself, Pinewood Lodge, primary school, and Ben Loman Lodge.
so I guess we are quite unique in that we are bound, like, surrounded on three sides by different zoning.
Yep. Now, in terms of the issue of the height of the car park in the building, you mentioned there are discussions that have taken place. So I understand that the current proposal by Skyline is for an 18.5-metre car park in the building. I'm not quite clear whether you're opposed to that height or simply wanting anything over that height to be controlled. What was, can you clarify that point for me?
Yes, that, the latter. So Kiwi Birdlife Park has signed off on the current proposal by subject to a number of conditions by Skyline for its car park building, but it's concerned about future development in that area having the height limit proposed by Skyline. So it supports council's position in that regard, which is just the increase to the 18.5 for the height limit in that area. So opposes Skyline, which is sort 20, is happy with council's latest position.
Okay. Would, would another 1.5 metres make any practical difference? I'm just wondering whether that would be, it really matters or not.
It's quite, it's the scale of the overall development that's there, and also being consulted with. So the if they're triggering a breach, then there's more likelihood that Kiwi Birdlife Park are going to be consulted with. And Kiwi Birdlife Park has, throughout this process with the redevelopment of the Skyline Terminal, had a really good relationship with Skyline, but it has been really important that they're in ongoing dialogue, because they don't, unless you're actively involved with the Kiwi Birdlife Park operations, you don't have a really good understanding of what's required in terms of mitigation, and they've worked really hard with Skyline. But if Skyline become in the position where they don't need to consult for future consents with Kiwi Birdlife Park, that's where the concern lies.
And then my final question is just about the helicopter landing site, which is now moved further away, I suppose, from your operations. I guess the thing that's been going through our minds a little bit here, but was trying to grasp on the scale of the activity that does occur with that helipad. Now, mention is made here of an environment board decision that suggested a limitation of 4. I mean, is that adhered to? Is that typical of the number of flights per day?
I believe so. I know before I'm in the park, nearly 10 years, and just before I started, there was a lot of negotiations about flight paths and the volume of flights.
Yeah.
Certain days it does seem more than that, but I don't think so. We don't actively get out and watch, but we do definitely hear them and are affected by the flight. So I guess it's the flight path and the sheer volume. If there's going to be an increase in that, that's what we're concerned about.
Zimtrek have raised the same concern.
Yeah.
Is it both the number of flights and the actual flight path that's a concern?
Yeah.
So they might understand from that if the flight path was further away or something
yeah.
like that, would be more.
If the flight path was further west, primarily, so further around, looping around us, would be more agreeable. Basically, for all of these things, we're not just trying to be difficult neighbours, we're just trying to mitigate the effects on our wildlife, on the welfare.
I take it that the issue of flights has been the subject of discussion between yourselves and Skyline.
Previously, but regarding this, we haven't really had discussions with them about this new proposal.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Nixon was asking you about your boundaries, and so the fences that you currently have around the Birdlife Park, are they fairly much on the boundaries of the site at the moment?
Yes, I know on the Pinewood side, the northern side, we're slightly set back from the boundary, but in general, yeah, it's pretty much on
the boundary. And are they... although you've said in your evidence that some of them aren't at the optimal 2.2 metres of height, but are they, some of them at that height or at there or about? So
yes,
there
or thereabouts. I think, especially on the school side, we're having issue with build-up of organic matter of with kids playing in the playground. There's a lot of build-up, so we have lost nearly, say, half a metre on that side. But in general, they're kind of between 1.8 and maybe 2 to 2.2.
And you mentioned that you've been through a resource consent process recently.
Yes.
And in terms of sort of the whole efficiency of being required to go through that process versus having some site-specific rules, I mean, just briefly, can you tell me what was involved and how it impacted on?
Well, it's a really good point about this, because that was an agreement with Skyline, and they actually did most of the consenting process. We're a team of conservationists, so when we don't have the planners at hand, such as in this case, it means we have to do it. And for us to do that planning is not really cost efficient, because again, we just have to weigh up every cent we spend where it's best spent. And I don't think battling through consenting processes, for me, being a non-planner, it will take a lot of time and a lot of finances away from what we should be doing, which is conservation.
Or you have to employ somebody,
yep,
which is more cost.
Exactly, more cost, basically.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. One thing that the map's very helpful, but I wonder if you could I'm aware of the topography in that zone. Could you, in terms of the edges and where the park sits, could you fill us in terms of the heights within it, because it drops down quite significantly.
It does, yeah. So, kind of on the skyline side of the park, we're just about to plant about 5,000 native trees, and that's quite a hilly site. And then as you get lower into the park, on the eastern side, on the school side, I should say, just to clarify, basically it does drop down quite a bit. So as we're going up towards Skyline, it's much more hilly, and then lower up the park is drops down quite a bit. So we've planted extensively on the lower side of the park. The upper side was primarily pine trees, so we've removed about 132 of them last year, which is a big job, and this year we're hoping to plant out about 5,000 trees in that area. And we will always leave a slight gap in our planting at the fence lines, so it's not going to encourage possums to climb up and climb up. So we'll be a bit of a buffer, just a couple of metres either side of our fence line boundary, which is important for predator control.
I was just trying to get, because the increase in height of every fence and how much of an impact that's going to have when you actually...
Well, basically, we want all of our aviaries, we want to seem as natural as possible. We want to accurately depict a setting as close to nature as possible. So we do plant extensively inside and outside of all of our aviaries, so they blend in as much as possible. That works better for exhibiting the animals, it's a more natural setting, and that should also help to reduce any visual impact of those taller aviaries.
And the impacts from Skyline, in terms of the car parking, is it building and construction primarily, or is it ongoing from there?
Well, obviously we don't know what additional operation noises will happen. So I think everyone knows, but we are having to relocate all of our Kiwi to this new proposed building. And we are planning that might be a permanent move, because we are expecting additional operational noises. We're just trying to roll with the punches, and we know that this development will benefit us for visitation, but we have to always put animal welfare top of our agenda. So we are expecting some additional operational noises, but primarily our main concern is the construction noises. Does that answer?
Yep, correct. Just in terms of the location, it's a CBD location almost.
Yep.
So there is an anticipated impact from traffic, which is interesting.
Yeah.
The predator protection, the 2 meter, 2.2 fences in the boundary, is there other ways that could be accomplished? Like audible inhibitors or?
We do trap on both sides, but when you're talking with such a suite of predators, like protecting from possums is very different to protecting from rats to mice, so we have to try and do as many different measures as possible. So we do run trapping lines throughout the park, but additional fencing is only going to benefit. And 1.2 metres does not allow any protection. Cats can jump straight over.
Let's talk about, by 2045, we're going to be predator-free New Zealand, given the fences then.
Yeah, you were knocked off 5 years, it's 2050, but 2050, if you want to do it 2045,
yeah,
that's even better.
Yeah, well then everyone just needs to start trapping.
Exactly.
But the one last question is 38926, which is the a rule that relates to your activities, and you were actually asking to insert keeping, breeding, and managing wildlife.
Yep.
The does that apply to the zoo? So would Skyline then be in position to? I'm just trying to clear in my own mind.
If we'll have a wildlife park next
time. It's actions and consequences. So that it's, I mean, if we were to support the action,
okay,
would there be any unintended consequences?
I guess I'm a conservationist, so I might have to defer to Vanessa on this question.
It would apply to the zone, that's correct.
So is that something that you'd support, or is there some other way that you would look to insert that wording to specifically apply to Kiwi Birdlife Park? Or? That's all my questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for the good work you do.
My client is here, I think. They must be just outside.
Thank you.
Now, we have read your legal submissions for this plan.
Thank you. Are you ready for me to commence?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm appearing for Books and Toys Wanaka Limited that lodged a submission and further submission. I have with me Mr. Brian Kreft, who is a director of the company, and Erin Quinn, the planning consultant. In my submissions, I referred in the background to why the points made in the submission are important to Books and Toys, and I thought it would be helpful if Mr. Kreft just spoke to that rather than what I've heard from Mr. Kreft. So he's just prepared the one-page summary, which he will read out, and then Ms. Quinn has prepared a summary too. As you've read my submissions, I won't go through them. Suffice to say that really the purpose of the submission is to ensure efficiency of the process. So similar to the submissions that were made this morning in respect of the Kiwi Birdlife Park, given the general nature of signage proposals, we want to ensure that the plan provisions are easy to interpret by lay people, and there's not costly debates with council in the future about these matters, which directly affect businesses and business feasibility. And as that's one of the key points, I will hand over to Mr. Kreft to make his submission, unless you have any questions for me following my submissions.
Yes.
You do.
I do.
Thank you.
It was really quite a general one. I was just wondering whether the submission lodged provides scope to redraft the provisions so as to remove the uncertainty and to make them understandable in the way that you're suggesting is needed in your legal submissions.
I have referred back to the submission, and my view is that there was scope. Did you have any specific concern, or would you like me to go through the relief sort?
I was just wanting to be sure that there was a broad provision in the submissions that would enable the removal of ambiguities and improvement of certainty.
We did seek the, so in terms of the provisions, the specific provisions, there's a number of the reasons given,
yes.
And then we sought specific relief in terms of the grandfathering, that there will, it will not require additional consents provided, deletions, and in respect of sale signage, and that the signs sited within the enclosed interior of the buildings visible from a public place are not subject to that rule, and then any further alternative or consequential changes relief necessary or appropriate for the submitter to pursue in order to address the matters and outcomes identified in the submission.
Do you think that provides the sort of scope for this question you need about?
Yes, I think so, but I actually think the specific relief in paragraphs C goes far enough in terms of the amendments that have been requested.
Okay.
And I also note in terms of scope that Wanaka Flooring Extra made very similar submission points, and Books and Toys submitted in support of that submission, and Ms. Leap relies on both of those submissions for scope in terms of the amendments suggested.
Thank you.
That all seems quite straightforward. It's certainly good to have a practical example of the problems that have been experienced to sort of illustrate
have to excuse me if my voice moves up and down. I have a medical condition which causes that, as it does my shaking. I have Parkinson's, and if I ever meet Mr. Parkinson, I'll tell him what he can do with this disease. Books and Toys Wanaka Limited training as Paper Plus Wanaka is a member of the Paper Plus cooperative group, which operates on a franchise-type basis, the same way as the Foodstuffs organisation. The Foodstuffs organisation corporate model is what is Paper Plus basis and stuff like that. And as a consequence, Paper Plus Wanaka holds shares in the Paper Plus group and in turn has been granted a franchise for the operation of the business. As franchisees, you'll appreciate that we are required to comply with the franchisor's reasonable requests and requirements, and if we are unable to do so, it places us into business in jeopardy. Hence our concern and the lack of clarity around the matters we are submitting on, because uncertainty is like a cancer in the business. Our position is also materially influenced by an incident that took place approximately eight years ago, when we were rebranding to the store in accordance with the Paper Plus requirements, upgrading to what is called Concept 6, which required a colour change and also a change in the signage wording. We duly made application to the Queensland Legislative Council in Wanaka and received verbal approval to the colour change and also the rewording of the exterior signage. These approvals were subsequently confirmed in writing. Subsequent to that, a planner at the Queensland Legislative Council in Queensland took exception to the green colour of the shop front facade, describing it as jarring and lurid, and commenced a rigorous enforcement action, including eliciting the support of Council's then enforcement officer, Mr. Francis. Incidentally, I point out that the green colour is the same as on the facade, is the same as the facade of the Council's own building in Queensland. Subsequently to that, a planner in Queensland, whilst there were no changes to the size of the exterior signage, the wording on the existing signage was also to be changed. Whilst not disputing the size of the existing signage, both the planner and Mr. Francis drew our attention to the window display posters and advised that in accordance with the rule, we were in breach of same as the interior window posters form part of the exterior signage area. Suffice to say, the threat of abatement notices were made and other enforcement threats, not only to ourselves as tenants of the building, but also to the landlord, despite the fact that the matter was being handled by our solicitors. The outcome of this sorry saga was that immediately prior to going to the Environment Court, then head planning officer for the QLDC, I think it was Mr. Fitzpatrick, his first name was Brian, on reviewing the matter, conceded that we were entitled to undertake what we had submitted to do, and that we should ignore the threat of the inclusion of the interior postage window display. As a consequence, we incurred legal and expert report costs of approximately $35,000, for which we have received no recovery, and we also lost faith, obviously, in the ability of the Council's officers to correctly interpret and enforce their own signage rules. Hence our very real concerns, as we've been expressed to you in the submissions which we've made through Anderson Lawyer.
I have to say I understand the issue quite well, having had a temporary role in the council's planning department and the file came across my desk. So I understand the location we're talking about.
Yep.
Et cetera.
I have a pleasant experience.
I have no questions.
Wait for 2 years yet.
No, thank you very much, and I'm also very familiar with your site, so I understand what you're referring to in the windows, for example.
I have no questions. I do fully understand what you're going through. You're probably fully aware that I'm on the lease of 7 years
now. Yeah,
aware
of that.
And I do find myself in a situation where you have cinema posters in the windows, and I'll hold my tender dry.
Summary. Would you like me to read it?
Yes, please.
All right, and you can hear me? My name is
Erin Quinn. I'm a planner and urban designer and work for Vivian Nesbitt. The submission lodged by Books and Toys Wanaka states that changes to be made to amend table 31.5. Specifically to state signage within an approved signage platform shall be a permitted activity, and in its current proposed form, the rule is ambiguous. They also seek clarification to rule 31.7.5b with respect to specifically excluding window product displays and deletion of part of rule 31.6.5, which restricts the number of temporary sale signs to one sign per sale. I've considered the views expressed by Ms. Leith in her rebuttal evidence dated the 22nd of August 2018. Ms. Leith considers in 4.1 of her evidence that section 42A rule 31.5.1 as amended is not ambiguous due to it excluding signage types listed as permitted, controlled or restricted discretionary within tables 31.7 to 31.9. Ms. Leith stated in part 12.6 of the section 42A report that to her knowledge, the definition of signage was not used in enforcement to control shopfront displays. I have been advised that the matter has been raised with the submitter by QLDC. The wording of 31.7.7 states that any sign or signage platform that does not comply with rules 31.7.1 to 31.7.6 is discretionary. It remains unclear if signs replaced within an improved signage platform need to comply with rule 31.7.7, which also means 31.7.1 to 31.7.6 in order to retain permitted status. I maintain the view that the section 42A rule 31.5.1 as written is ambiguous and requires further clarification as outlined in the submission to aid practical interpretation of the rule by the general public. If a simple addition is outlined in paragraph 2.5 of my evidence can be made to clarify a rule for practical interpretation, it should therefore not be necessary to refer to other sections of the plan. Ms. Leith considers in paragraph 4.2 of her rebuttal regarding rule 31.75b that posters should not be excluded from window and product displays, as this would create confusion due to posters being included within the definition of signage. I note that the definition of signage is broad enough to include many items intended to attract attention and which are visible from a public place. The broad definition is not conducive to fairly assisting commercial establishments, achieve policy 31.2.16a. Ms. Leith also considers the potential effects of large posters within a shopfront display could be the same as a sign being a two-dimensional static drawing and should not be treated the same as a display of physical products. In my opinion, this is a broad assumption that a two-dimensional static drawing will have the same environmental effect, regardless of the poster's design, when they are directly associated with the product displays. This is a generic assumption. The rule is, in my opinion, overly restrictive by limiting the consideration of window displays to physical goods only. The reference to the 1 metre setback for signage as proposed does not appear to work or address the concerns raised by Ms. Leith. I concur that window displays do enhance the street environment. However, find that posters which complement these products or services within window displays can be placed and designed so as to also enrich and enliven the street environment and encourage customer patronage. The use of temporary posters and window displays are used to attract attention of customers to a given product or service and are complementary in this regard. The reasoning given by Ms. Leith is that this will cause confusion in practical terms does not, in my opinion, warrant exclusion of the provision of posters in window displays. I maintain the opinion that temporary posters in window displays should be exempt from Rule 31.7.5b and should there be concerns with regard to amenity fees and the permanence of signage in window displays, then this could be managed on a time allowance basis. To conclude, with regard to Rule 31.6.5, noted by Ms. Robb as previously overlooked, the rationale between the restriction of sale signage to one sign has, in my opinion, not been sufficiently clarified. This is particularly relevant where there are instances of businesses having more than one public street elevation. I'm of the opinion that a time allowance restriction on sale signage is sufficient in managing possible effects as the subject signage is purposefully informative and temporary only. any questions?
Yes. I'm just wondering, Ms. Quinn, as a planner, how does one expect in a commercial area such as town centre zone for there to be signage?
For there to be signage?
Yes.
How does one expect? Can you clarify that question?
In a town centre zone, would, as a planner, you expect to see signage?
Yes.
Yes.
I find that I would expect to see signage and I anticipate that effect because it's informative. A lot of the signage is informative. I understand that there are controls around some signage, but in my opinion, as I stated in my summary, it's gone too far in some disregard.
And in terms of window displays, thinking about commercial areas around New Zealand, is it unusual for window displays to have a mixture of goods and signs?
It's not unusual.
Is there anything special about Wanaka in Queenstown that would distinguish the way we should deal with signs in our town centres from, say, Rotorua, Tauranga, Christchurch?
No.
I sort of take the evidence and the issues as much about the clarification of the law as it is about the law itself. Just trying to understand the displays issue. I know you've been involved with other council members, people have grappled with that. A generally accepted signage rule should encompass a sign that's attached to the glass in front of the window pane, for example, on the outside, or if it's on the inside. And once you go beyond that, you go into the shop itself, it's generally not controlled because it opens up an enforcement nightmare of significant proportions. Am I to take it that one of these issues you're concerned about is control over goods and services that are actually not attached to the window, but inside the window? So is that what the concern is about?
That's what the concern is about. That's what, in my understanding, that's the concern is potential enforcement of by council of a rule within the window display area,
yeah.
In internal space.
So where a number of councils don't go there, basically, they go to the window and stop.
So I think, especially when I've been reading the evidence today, it's unclear as to where and why the control of the signing provision stops.
On the same theme, because the one rule that you've commented on is about actual signage. So let's put posters of products to one side for a minute. Just talk about a sign, if you can distinguish them. So the council's agreed that signs that are more than 1 metre inside the shop or of premises shouldn't be considered as a sign, but they've also tagged on this requirement that they also shouldn't be able to be seen from the public place. And I think as you've raised, as I recall, this concern that, well, it depends how good your eyesight is, and you can actually see, you can often see more than a metre inside. Does that place an unreasonable sort of limitation on just general shop signage inside the shop?
I just think that the way it's written, if I was, this is from a planning perspective and me trying to give advice to a client with a business, it would be very difficult to interpret what is actually allowed based on that provision.
Mm.
And I wouldn't feel confident as a professional with my advice based on the wording of that role.
Yes, because even if it's more than 1 metre inside, if someone stood there and looked, there's a chance someone could see it.
And
which
then it's all, that's
uncertainty.
Right. And then it's all relative to the design of the the actual premise itself.
Yes, and the size
and
of it.
And the size of the window. And, you know, so there's a lot of varying factors. So that consistency and application would be problematic, in my opinion.
Yes, and then with the posters that, the council's agreed that displays of products in a window shouldn't be considered to be signs, but you've said that your clarification is posters of products are no different than the products themselves in terms of providing a window display. Would that be normal to have a mix of posters that also relate to the products plus the products themselves in a display?
Yes, I would consider that to be normal, and I also wouldn't. I think that it would be almost. I think it's more about the effect of the actual outcome of that, the particular window display, as opposed to just having a generic rule that's one size fits all. I don't think that would be particularly successful in achieving the objectives intended in the signage chapter as proposed. I think that it's, as I said in my summary, it kind of limits the flexibility of commercial enterprises within their own spaces to promote products and overly so.
Yes. So I just have one more question. It's about this grandparenting, or if you could call it that, provision, and to be clear about replacement signs within an approved signage platform. At the moment, there are two rules, but in the commercial zone, there's the one that you've pointed to, which is, for each of the zones, there's a rule within the standards for the particular areas, in this case the commercial areas, that says that new and replacement signs located within an approved signage platform are permitted.
It's
which 7.2. And then there's this little advice note underneath it which says, but in order to do that you have to meet the permitted act, you have to comply with the conditions of the original approved signage platform, which seems fair enough. Leith says, well, that's enough to have it in each of those areas. You're suggesting sort of replicating that provision up in the main list for all activities in order to overcome your concern about 31.5.1. What I was wondering was, given that those rules are already in there in 31.7.2 and the one for open space signs or whatever, could it be that 31.5.1 is just written more clearly? Because 31.5.1 is really just a default, isn't it? For things that just aren't covered anywhere else, you become full discretionary. I mean, if it just said signs which are not listed in this table or in table 31.5, 31.7, 31.8, 31.9, anywhere, not listed at all in those ones, would that overcome your concern? I mean, rather than duplicating
the rule that
you're suggesting.
Yeah, I think that from a practical perspective that could, provided that, what that comment was based on the fact that from a planning perspective, it would be a lot easier if it was just stated in the generic first table if this is going to be permitted, right? And then rather than going back in a few pages later and then referring to this particular chapter for this particular commercial area and then leafing through the whole signage chapter to find it.
Okay.
If it was simplified just to with recognition to signage platforms, I think, than that, like you
have
said,
it all up front.
If have it all up front, that would be a lot easier from a practical point of view. And
yes.
Using the district plan.
Yeah, especially when it's repeated in more than one of the sets of standards about different areas.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I understand where you came from. If it's overly repetitive, then that can cause confusion as well. So if it is simplified in a different way, if it achieves the same thing, then that would be, I'd be understandable.
Yeah. But I can understand, I mean, I understand your evidence about why there's a confusion. It's just, I guess, about
how to do it.
I think that's why the chairman had the generic, had the question, the legal question, you know, the submission from you and from my flooring, perhaps broad enough to now enable some tidying up and improving the certainty and lengthening the ambiguity in these rules. Yeah.
I presume also that if there's an existing consent for a signed platform, the zoning of it is irrelevant because it has a consent and the rules are really only related to the changing of the signs on the platform within the terms of the original condition. It doesn't matter whether it's in the local shopping centre zone, the town centre zone or any other zone because it has a consent anyway. That your fair analysis? Because that's the reason of the later ones is to distinguish between the various zones. But that's an instance where the zone it was in when it got the consent is probably more relevant at the time when they got the consent.
Yes, I think that's a valid point. I suppose by having it explicitly stated in the zone provisions, then you're not having that discussion with council about how it should be treated and if.
Well, if it's in the general one that says it applies in all zones.
Yes,
yes.
Yes.
For instance, it may have been in this township zone. It was a shop and it got an approval of the signage platform and it's now zoned low density residential.
Mm. Yes, I take your point on that. I think that would be a very simplistic way of dealing with it. Not sure that this mission does give you that jurisdiction.
Someone's
mine. Yes, someone's
mine. Just a big full check.
Yep.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you
for your evidence.
That was helpful. Yeah, I have a vexed issue with signage. Just with regard to 3165, which is the temporary sales sign, in your professional opinion, how would you enforce that?
The rule as it stands is one sign per unit per sale. How would I enforce that? So if someone had more than one sign.
Yeah, but if you had one sign, and also in terms of minimum 14 days between the displays of temporary sales.
So you're trying to say that you couldn't enforce that because you've only got 14 days? I'm trying to understand the question. The rule is about having more than one temporary sale sign up, right? So if you've got more than one, then it could be enforceable action.
Yep. So there's one sign there.
Right. So if you've
got
more than
complies.
One.
So that it complies, there's only one sign, but the minimum of 14 days. And my question is, if you were, in your opinion as a planner, would you write a rule in that fashion?
The issue that the submission, that was overlooked, the issue was the number of signs.
Oh, yes.
Because they've got two, if you've got two public street elevations, that's what the issue was that we would.
I'm with you.
Is that, yeah.
Not the time.
Elmore Street and Howard Street.
Absolutely. The concern I've got, and I raised it with Councillor Pitard, was how would you go about enforcing it? And I think, from memory, the response was, well, we wouldn't. And at that point, it's like, well, why, are you comfortable with the rule? And that's sort of what I was getting at, was if you're...
All right.
You're actually drafting a rule surely it needs to be something that's got a benefit, that's enforceable. It's, that was the point I was swimming towards.
I would just find that it would unnecessarily invoke not fear, but a little bit of confusion and I'm trying to find the word fear, but being a little bit worried about what you're actually allowed to do, and that has its ongoing effects unnecessarily to the commercial enterprise.
Which goes to Mr. Craft's point, which is basically that everything was fine until someone took exception, and then the exception was taken on several levels.
Yeah.
And $35,000 later, we are who we are.
On a paint, pencils and rubbers.
Indeed. No, thank you. That's my only question. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I have just, while we've been talking, had another look at the relief, and I do think it is quite broad in the submission, because it does say, in terms of this grandfathering report, all necessary amendments being made to the proposed provisions to ensure that any change in signage within an improved signage platform will not require additional consents, provided the change in signage complies with any conditions of approval. So there's not just a specific reference to a rule, it said any changes made.
So this comes there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you,
Pam. Thank you for your time this morning.
Ms. Paul, do you think you might want to get back to me on the key builder? If we talk to the submitter, then we'll hear for months before we have any more to do that. Today is our last day.
Yes.
I'm happy if you file something for you, not perhaps this afternoon, that might be.
Happy to do that. That would
be simpler for you.
Yes, it was. I was going to suggest that I come take instructions and come back, but if that's acceptable to you, that would be preferred, that I could just go, I could clarify those instructions now, and I think it would be a pretty straightforward response that I could file this afternoon.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'll take the morning adjournment now.
Oh, it's 10 minutes. 10 minutes.